Okay, so I am here with Mary Robinette Cowell, who was most recently the author of Shades of Milk and Honey. Mary, how are you doing?
I'm doing very well, thank you.
Yes, but you're not drinking honey.
Or milk. I'm not. Yeah. Gingerade, though.
Gingerade, though. Well, Shades of Gingerade, Milk, and Honey. I wanted to, first of all, start with the language used in this book, the specific Jane Austen template that you laid out. You took great care to mimic Jane Austen's particular spellings. You used choose with a U instead of choose with double O, shoe instead of show, surprise and tease spelled with a Z. But on the other hand, you didn't, for example, hyphenate today and things along those lines. So I wanted to first of all, and nuncheon, but Jane Austen never used nuncheon.
That's not true. She used it twice.
Where?
She used it in Lady Susan and Sense and Sensibility.
Ah, okay. Well, in any event, the hard choices of vocabulary, I wanted to first of all start how this came about, why go ahead and emulate this language. Was the idea here to create a series of limitations with which to approach a long-form novel, or what came first here?
I find that language reflects society very closely. The reason I wound up using some of her spellings it's really an affectation. You know, I am trying to pretend that this is something that could have been written then. I deviated from her spellings in places where I thought it would be confusing.
Yeah.
In places where I didn't feel like the word was going to appear often enough for a reader to get used to it. An example of a word that was confusing was she spelled stayed, like she stayed at home, S-T-A-I-D.
That's right.
Which is a different word now. The word sofa appears, I think, once in the novel, and she spelled it S-O-P-H-A. And like, you know.
Yeah.
There's not actually a reason to stop people. I actually thought that they were going to make me change all of the spellings. But it's, I guess you can think of it as dressing up in Regency clothes.
Yeah.
But remembering, of course, that it's still going to a costume party.
By they, are you referring to Liz Gorinsky or
yes,
the copy editors?
Well, Liz Gorinsky, the production department, I thought that someone in the editing line was going to say, hey, we need to change that. The copy editor, once we decided with Liz and marketing to keep the spellings, and we did lift out some of them. Then I gave copy editor a style sheet that said, these are the deliberately misspelled words.
Yeah.
Please do not change them.
Yeah. Which words didn't make the cut? I'm curious.
Sofa, stayed, there was all of the todays and tomorrows.
So those were originally spelled that way in your original draft?
Yeah.
Okay, wow. Kind of interesting.
Yeah. I can't remember what some of the others were, but I did a find replace. I can't remember where I found it, but I found a Jane Austen spelling list.
Huh.
And I went through and did a find replace on everything, and then we went back and undid that. So it's funny because there's a couple of places where I know that there's at least one choose that we missed, and it's still spelled with two O's.
Yeah.
But, you know.
Well, goodbye to that, I suppose.
Yeah, well, you know, second edition.
Yeah. this is interesting because I'm wondering if it took you several practice tries to write in this particular meticulous style.
I would read a chapter of Jane Austen and then write a chapter. So I was reading Persuasion while I was writing this. And one of the things that I picked up from the puppetry is that I frequently have to mimic someone else's style. So once I decided to do this, I sat down and started reading Austen. And then the reason I was writing right after finishing reading a chapter was because I knew that the language would stick and the rhythms would stick. But I don't think that I really did a practice run.
Yeah.
I mean, certainly I went back and fixed things later.
Yeah. To make it a little bit more emulated.
Yeah.
And the like.
But at the same time, I mean, this is still written for a modern reader. Like, I have way more description in this than Jane Austen would ever put in.
Yeah.
And she also, when she was writing, she would do a section of dialogue, and then she would have a narrative section that would kind of bridge to the next dialogue scene, which is not a modern convention. And she would also, she was using an omniscient voice, so she would go from character's head to character's head, depending on who she wanted to be in during the scene.
Yeah.
Multiple characters in a scene, and that is out of fashion these days. So I elected to deliberately not do that.
Well, this idea of emulation, I'm curious if you did the similar things with your short stories, where you did that. You've done this for every piece of fiction you've written. You've had to have some initial stylistic source to jump off from.
Or? No. I've done it occasionally.
Yeah.
Clockwork Chickadee, which is in Clark's World magazine.
Yeah.
I wanted to write something along the lines of the Just So stories. So I sat down and read some Rudyard Kipling, and then jumped from there. That's the only other one that I can think of where I very specifically said, I want to steal this style. But I'm aware that when I read something, that it will have an influence on voice. So when I'm writing, I do tend to pick things that will complement whatever I'm writing.
Yeah.
Because I figure if I'm going to... I figure that there are two choices there. I can either avoid all other influence, which means, you know, not getting to read.
Yeah.
Or I can say, well, you know, this is going to happen. And it's kind of like getting a patch, an automatic upgrade on writing, because
yeah.
The things that stick are the things you like best.
Sure, sure.
So I just pick the authors that most compliment and happily let things stick.
But I'm curious how this factors into, I suppose, the, if we're going to use computer terms, the default Mary mode. I mean, I know, for example, you really like to use nouns, both in the short stories and in this novel.
Mm-hmm.
You really like to weight sentences down, I would say, with nouns. Would this be an example of having, I suppose, a base with which to, I suppose, accentuate the cake with the frosting and icing of, say, Jane Austen in this
case? Yes, yeah. I think that every author, I mean, there are certain tics that every author will have. It's hard for me to tell what my default voice is because it's like being able to define your own skin in some ways. You know, you really have to be outside or have a way to step outside to really get a sense of the whole thing. It's like I could not at all tell you what my back looks like, but I use it every day.
Yeah. Well, that's an interesting way of putting it, but I mean, on the other hand, I'm wondering why. I mean, some authors, some fiction writers say, well, if I read, as you say, it's going to rub off into my own fiction, and others can just read fiction without that risk. I'm wondering why you feel that for you, the influence of a fictional voice is just naturally going to rub off on you more so than, say, other writers.
Oh, I think it rubs off on everybody. I would be surprised, actually, to meet someone who didn't have it rub off. I suspect that I'm just conscious of it. And that other people are perhaps unconscious of it. You know, or maybe I'm, you know, more malleable. Or,
yeah.
You know, I don't know.
Who's really the puppet here?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
But most of my training has been to match the style to the story. So, you know, and that's from a design mode. And I feel like words are very much the same way. You match the style to the story, and although you will be able to tell who the original designer is in all likelihood, it still doesn't mean that you have to do exactly the same thing every time.
Yeah. Do you think that the notion of authorial imprint is perhaps overstated? That really we read a book because we want to access that world, and I'm wondering how this relates to you. I mean, someone might read this book and say, because you decide to do a different style for each particular piece of fiction, it may not be a Mary Robin and Cole book. It may just be, you know, Shades of Milk and Honey.
You know, I think everybody has different reasons for reading things.
Yeah.
My own reasons for reading are going to be because of the characters and the world. And I want fiction that is easy to read and flows and adds to the story, but I don't tend to read for style. I know there are people who tend to read for style.
Yeah.
And I'm not one of those. So I write things that I want to read.
Sure.
Which for me always means that the style is in service of the story.
Makes sense. I wanted to, going back to style, I wanted to talk about how you adopted the word law for Melody's dialogue. Now, I know that that's in Pride and Prejudice and that is in Sense and Sensibility,
mm-hmm.
but it's not in there all that much in those two books. Whereas in this book, you have Melody use law probably 40 maybe 50 times. And I'm curious why that particular tick rubbed off. It almost became something entirely yours by way of taking something minor in Austin and transforming it into something major with this particular dialogue.
I suspect one of the reasons that that happened is because the characters that used La in Pride and Prejudice and Sense and Sensibility weren't main stage characters.
Yeah.
They were secondary characters. Melody is on stage a lot more.
Yeah.
I think that if you look at the actual amount of dialogue and the proportion, I think proportionally it's in Melody's dialogue as much as it is in the dialogue of the characters who use it in the other two books. She's just on stage a lot more. It may also be that I just overplayed it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I didn't mind it, but I mean, I'm curious what the appeal of Law was for you.
It's such an expressive word. It's so dismissive. And it's just so much fun.
Yeah.
La.
Well, the other thing, too, is it really cuts down on la, 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 which is today.
Yeah.
In the 21st century. And then back then in the 19th century, you could just say la and do the same thing.
Yeah, I think, it's blah, blah,
shorthand.
Blah.
Yeah. Okay. Speaking of 21st century and 19th century, there are a few sly parallels in the book to contemporary life. The neatly rendered glamour amidst mahogany furniture, which creates an artificial fireplace. The suggestion of digital, when Mr. Vincent says, "I dream of a day when it is possible to move images from one location to the next without the human effort to keep the folds from unraveling."
Mm-hmm.
And then late in the book, when Jane is having difficulty with a horse, you write that the countryside rolled past with all the haste of a Saturday picnic. Now, that's a particular metaphor that is just as applicable to present life as it was back then. I'm wondering how much the present day was a concern when you were writing this book and trying to, I suppose, seduce the reader into inhabiting a world, but also offering little parallels like this so that they can enter this new old world that was both unfamiliar and yet familiar with these particular metaphors I just described.
I don't actually think of any of those as being 20th century metaphors. Now I want to look at them again.
Well, the fact that there's an art, they long for developments that occur 200 years later. The artificial fireplace, the digital swapping of digital cameras and the like. And so, at least that's what I caught.
Oh, well, I mean, being able to move images from place to place is something that develops in our actual history. I knew the answer to this. I think it's like the advent of photography is, I think, only maybe 15 years after this.
Yeah.
So this is something that people have been striving for a long time. That's, I don't know that that was, if only we could have computers. I did want this to be accessible to modern readers. And Jane Austen, as much as I love her, is accessible to... There are a number of people who don't want to take the time to sink into her pace and rhythms.
Yeah.
And it does require an adaptation. So, as I think I said before, that I wrote a book that I wanted to read. I don't know how conscious... Certainly any of those examples were of let me introduce the modern reader. The examples that I would cite for let me help the modern reader along are things like where I slow down and describe rooms or take the time to, on the first page where I talk about the estate was entailed and then I explain what that means. There are things like that I wouldn't, Austin would never have to do because it was a... 1814 is a foreign country for us, and those were all things that everyone just would have known. So those are what I think of more as things that I did to help a modern reader. Huh. Why did you say roll along?
Sorry?
Why did you pick roll along as a...
Well, it was rolled past with all the haste of a Saturday picnic. A Saturday picnic I could buy, because, of course, some people will go to church on Sunday. Saturday is traditionally known as the day of rest. And even now, I see people, at least in Central Park and the like, sometimes doing Saturday picnics, at least during the summer. It could just be that because I happen to read your book during the summer, that may have stuck out.
I think so.
No, I mean, I suspect that these were probably unconscious or subconscious.
Yeah, yeah.
But I do want to talk about what you were saying here about the pace and the book you wanted to write was this book. I mean, did you ever worry that a paste book might be incompatible with the needs of, I suppose, your reading audience?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. You know, I knew that this would be, for a lot of people, that this would be very slow. Especially for fantasy readers, for hardcore fantasy readers, because there's so much epic fantasy where it's all action all the time and intrigue and plot. And when you get into an intimate story, the plot is there, but it's really just dealing with personal interactions a lot more. So I knew that that would probably happen. I knew that we would probably have people who got bored with this. This is not the book for them.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think that every book is for every reader. So I wrote a book for people who are interested in characters and character interactions.
Well, that's also a tough sell, because there are some fantasy people who do want the action and who do want extremely descriptive passages and won't settle down for the Jane Austen slower pace. I guess you just didn't care about this kind of audience?
Well, I think that it's frankly foolish to think that you can write a book that will appeal to everybody.
Yeah.
You know, that would be... It just doesn't even make sense.
Yeah.
Because the people who, you know, the people who like Jane Austen aren't necessarily the people who are going to like the giant swashbuckling fantasies, but should the giant swashbuckling fantasies slow their pace down for the Jane Austen people? Just, you know,
Is this why you possibly approach some of these online Austen junkies? I mean, hey, there's free marketing with your research here, free outreach here.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of crossover there.
Yeah.
And those are the... It's interesting, because a really hardcore Jane Austen fan is going to be turned off because of the places where I deviated.
Yeah.
The people who, you know, and they'll catch every single place where I messed up vocabulary. And the hardcore fantasy people are going to be, you know, there's not enough.
Yeah.
There's not. I've seen some people who were upset because the magic doesn't do very much. I'm like, no, it doesn't. That was kind of the point.
Yeah, yeah.
It's, you know, it is the book that it is.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's interesting. I mean, I'm wondering at what point during the editing that you finally said, look, there's no way we're going to be, I suppose, in this austere Austen mode. Let's just let it go. It is what it is. Let's loosen the attempt to mimic it exactly and to, I suppose, defy the sort of feverish fanboy, fangirl, Austen fanboy, fangirl. I mean, at what point did you sort of...
That was fairly early on, because I could have matched her style a lot closer than I did. It would have taken longer to write, and it would have spent a lot more time following up on some vocabulary things, but you know, matching somebody's style is a parlor trick. That's the hard part. Like matching someone's actual prose, that's a parlor trick. Matching someone's intentions and ideas, that's a significantly harder thing.
Yeah.
So I didn't try to match those. I lifted some characters and filed some serial numbers off. And I tried to write something that I thought would fit into the general, the general feel of things that she would write.
Sure.
But pretty early on, I knew that I was writing something for modern readers. From the puppetry background, you always start by defining parameters. And the parameters are audience, size of venue, and then cost. And then once you define those, then you know what style of puppet you want to use, how long the show will be, and how big it's going to be. But you first have to know, you know, that the primary two are who your audience is and how big it's going to take place, you know, how big the theater is.
Sure.
In a book, you still have to know who your audience is, or at least I believe you do, that you have to start with thinking about who your audience is. And you have to decide, when we talk about size of theater, you have to decide how long it's going to be. You know, is it a novel, a short story, what have you? Screenplay, stage play, those are all different venues. So for me, that's one of the first things I decide.
Yeah.
So I knew I was writing for modern audience. I knew I was writing for people who like Jane Austen or like that style of story. And I knew I was writing novel length.
Did you keep the bar, I suppose, in terms of amount of audience or number of heads coming by tickets low?
No, I mean, that's not...
Something you can't calculate that?
You can't calculate that. And that's also something that can be manipulated. I knew I wanted to write a commercial book.
Sure.
And I knew that Jane Austen was popular. You know, if I wanted to write a period book where I was matching style and that was going to be unpopular, there's a whole host of classic authors I could have picked. But Jane Austen is popular. I mean, I didn't pick her because she's popular. I picked her because I like her. I knew that it would probably be a commercial novel because she's popular.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
No, it totally does. I wanted to also ask about one really interesting descriptive tick you use in this, and that is people who are constantly trampling upon the ground or rapping upon doors or rapping upon hands or just that physical presence of like tap, 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 rap, 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 which I noticed heavily throughout the book. It's a nice counterpoint to the glamour in the book, which is all about folding and slip-knotting and putting everything into a sort of gossamer-like line.
Right.
I wanted to ask about, number one, first, we haven't even gotten into how you devised the rules of glamour in this. Second, I wanted to ask about how conscious you were of the taps and the raps as a way to, I suppose, telegraph reality amidst all this magical tinkery.
Let's see. Do you want me to tackle rules of glamour first? Or
whatever you want.
We'll tackle rules of glamour first. So this is all stuff that is not on the page at all.
Yeah.
I'll start with the stuff that is on the page, actually, and then I'll talk about the stuff that's not. What's on the page is that it's a womanly art, and the language that is used to describe it is all textile-based, and mostly in either textile or textile and French. And I decided that since it was a womanly art, women were probably the ones coming up with the names, hence the textiles. The other thing that I decided was that French was the language of fashion. Much like music has Italian as its language, and German at the time was popular mostly for sciences, I think, although my history is now a little fuzzy. But I decided that French was the language of fashion for glamour. This is the stuff that's not on the page. In what they call the deep story, which is the point at which this alternate history diverges from ours. Back in the dawn of history, fairy never diverged, never separated from humanity. They just interbred. So every living human on Earth is part fairy. Everybody has the second sight. And what the second sight allows you to do is see glamour. Some people have better sight than others do, just like regular vision, just like any kind of coordination. Some people are just playing better at it. In theory, what this allows you to do is to manipulate the electromagnetic spectrum. That's what glamour is. So the manipulation of it causes it to lose some of its power, some of its strength. So it's like painting with light. It's like doing a Trump oil painting. You can create the illusion of a sunbeam, but if you stick something in it, it's not significantly brighter than the rest of the room. A little bit, but not bright. I also decided that you had to tie the glamour off. I can't remember actually if it turns up in this one. I know it's in the second book. That I refer to tying it off to ley lines. But you're basically tying the light to the earth. That's what you're doing.
It must be the second book.
I think it must be the second book. I know I talk about tying things off, but I don't think I actually, because we don't, there are no lessons in this one.
Yeah.
So I don't think we actually get into anything more tangible than that, than generalities. But you have to tie it off. If you don't, then it just immediately evaporates unless you continue to hold it, manipulate it. Once you've tied it off, in order, it's stationary It will slowly unravel and decay, just the way anything slowly unravels and decays. The farther something is out to the ends of the spectrum, the faster it unravels and the more energy it takes to manipulate. So when they're manipulating cold, what they're doing is, they can actually manipulate heat. They don't. And the reason they don't is because they're manipulating microwaves, which have a tendency to kill people. And it takes way more energy than just starting a freaking fire.
All this backstory, not in the book.
Not in the book.
Yeah.
But I had to figure out what the rules were.
Yeah.
No, and because part of it is that certain aspects of it, you know, a lot of it just, you know, it just doesn't come up in the story. So why, you know, there are things that I kind of like, well, if I'd known people were going to complain about that, then I would have explained. But, you know, you never know what people are going to complain about.
That's really funny because, I mean, we only get the idea that the book in this, which suggests that there are efforts to try to chronicle the language of glamour. And of course, there's also this idea that when one partakes in glamour, that you really, it requires a lot of stamina,
mm-hmm.
requires a lot of energy. In devising the rules of glamour, did you factor in the common observation that a 19th century person, when shuttled possibly to our present speed, they would not be able to take that? They would not have the energy possibly or the stamina to deal with that pace of life. Whereas back then, you have them collapsing when they use glamour. You have
No. I don't. First of all, I don't agree with the initial observation.
Okay.
But second of all, no. It's more like if you run up a hill, it takes energy.
Yeah.
So the reason they collapse when they use too much glamour is just from overheating. And the reason the women are more prone to do it is because they're wearing short stays.
Yeah.
So they just can't take as deep a breath.
Yeah.
You just get more winded faster.
So it's a celestial triathlon, basically.
Hmm?
A celestial triathlon, you would say.
A celestial what?
Glamour, using glamour would be a celestial triathlon.
Yes. Kind of. No, I mean, it's not. It uses energy. But it's like, you know, walking to the end of the block, running up the hill. When you're doing a giant glamural, then it's, you have to lay a lot more threads. So you have to run a lot more. It's like running all day. And that, yes, that would be like the celestial triathlon. But, you know, if I were like, oh, let's make this room a little quieter.
Yeah.
And just put a little silence bubble around us, that's not such a big deal because you're only handling one fold.
Yeah. But what's interesting is that there's a vaguely exploitative quality to how one sets of characters uses Mr. Vincent and to create this glamoural, and essentially it's kind of like, you know, glamorous slave labor.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, that is one of the reasons that I set it up that it was that it took a significant amount of physical energy, because I wanted it to be something that only the leisure class, you have to have time and spare energy to do this.
Yeah.
So only the leisure class do it, and just like everything else the leisure class does, you know, they do not make their own furniture or their own clothes, they don't cook their own meals, they don't paint their own walls.
Yeah.
All of it is hiring someone else. Now he's paid, and he's paid well to do that, but they're totally hiring him to do something that they would not do themselves.
Yeah. Well, I mean, in light of the slave labor, I mean, this made me wonder if you had some sort of long-term baseball plan here, where if you have a human world that has glamour in its life, inevitably, when you throw that, or you merge that with capitalism, there's probably going to be some sort of export processing zone for
glamour. No, because you can't move glamour.
Uh-huh.
You cannot move it from point A to point B unless someone is holding it constantly, and it has to be a skilled person. So, and even a skilled person holding a complex glamour together, I mean, it would be like, you know, if you had a tray with a whole bunch of glasses piled on it and you needed it to move from one table to the other, you can probably do it. If you needed to walk down the block with it, there's no way you're going to do it without dropping a glass and probably the entire tray. It's that kind of thing.
You should have a supplemental rules of glamour on your site.
I should have a supplemental.
This is really interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah.
But in terms of slavery, if there's a book, probably five, which I jokingly call Gone with the Wind with Magic. which involves the children and grandchildren in America.
Yeah.
And there you do actually see how it is completely horrifically misused.
So you're talking six books with this, possibly.
There are a number of different stories that I would like to tell.
Yeah.
I was contracted to write a second book, which I've written and turned in. There are a couple of additional stories that I would like to tell. There's a book three that is plotted.
Yes.
But and then there's kind of a, I know there should be a book four about here, and then there's book five.
See, because I wanted to ask you, because Melody's eyes are cornflower blue.
Mm-hmm.
Mentioned, I believe, three times in
yeah.
the book. I wondered if this was a nod to Dorothy Dunnett's Frances Crawford in the Lyman Chronicles.
No, because I haven't read those.
Oh, okay. Well, why cornflower blue? Is this your Chuck Palahniuk response, or...?
I have no idea. I wrote it in 2006.
Yeah.
So there are some things that I'm just like, I don't know. That's one of those things that I don't know if I picked it up from someone else, or if I just... I was just reading another book. What was I reading? I was just reading another book, and they had a character who had cornflower blue eyes. I'm like, huh. And it's something that was out in the last year.
Huh.
So it may just be a general zeitgeist thing.
Got it. We should probably also go back to the Telegraph issue I had mentioned before. Tapping, rapping, lots of characters. Often the older characters sticking their canes and their feet into the ground. A sort of kind of a terra firma descriptive metaphor to balance off... To balance the glamour, how conscious were you of this tapping and rapping? Because it's very, very frequent in this first book.
Yeah, it's not so much... I'm not conscious... I was not doing it to balance the glamour.
Yeah.
I am conscious of the fact that my characters tend to touch things quite a bit.
Yeah.
And that actually shows up in... I think that's a writer tick. The reason I tend to do that is because... It goes back to the puppetry training. In puppetry, there's a number of... There are four different principles of puppetry, and one of them is called meaningful movement, which is that every time your character moves, it needs to mean something. And so I feel like whenever my characters... When there's body language, it should, if possible, not just be like a shrug or a nod, because that... tells you very little. It should, if possible, express their emotional state and also define the location that they are in. So I try, when I do body language, to have it doing two things at once.
Yeah.
But in terms of as a thematic counter to glamour, that's completely unconscious.
Okay. Fair enough. I wanted to also ask, I mean, to take this into comparisons between your puppeteering and writing. If it seems to me you envision the reader as a kind of audience to control or a puppet to control, how do you contend with the fact that, well, you may be able to have an action or a gesture indicate something, but you're never going to quite get a uniform reader response? Every reader is going to be different. What do you do to create spontaneity or leeway just as an author, from both the author and the reader standpoint? What you may mean may be different from what a reader may mean, or as I've sort of been digging up some things here that I found that you weren't aware of, or there are things that you put there that I'm not aware of. So,
yeah.
So what do you do to sort of contend with this dilemma?
Well, I mean, readers will bring their own thematic elements to something. You can have your ideas and hope that they will get them. But one of the interesting things about writing is that it is, it's kind of like a form of telepathy. You know, there's an idea that I have in my head, and I put it down on this piece of paper, and then I hope that it creates something that's close to the same idea in your head, while knowing that that's probably not actually going to work. There are certain things that you can do that will probably always have the same effect, that will have the same effect on vast majority of your readers. A blatant example, which is not in the book, but just of body language that that will probably provoke a similar reaction in most people who read it is if you have a villain and you have him kick a puppy, everyone will decide he's a bad man. Now, you can have him slaughter people. You can have people killed. You can do this with a good guy, actually.
Yeah.
Good guy. Kills people, no problem. This is completely fine. Good guys can steal things. Totally fine. The moment they kick the puppy, they are no longer a good guy. Almost without fail.
Yeah.
There are totally ways to manipulate an audience. But it's not always going to be 100% reliable. Because you're going to have that one audience member who hates dogs and is delighted to see the puppy kicked.
Yeah. Or you could have a character kick a puppy and then otherwise do perfectly moral or noble actions.
Yeah.
And in which case, it makes things interesting. I mean, when you're talking about elements of control like this, to what degree do you want to break outside the standard protag versus antag?
Well, let me go back to the principles of puppetry.
Sure.
Because when I'm manipulating an audience, and it's something that every author does. That is our job. There are four principles of puppetry. Focus indicates thought, and this is the one that I think is one of the most useful. Focus indicates thought. What your puppet is looking at is what it's thinking about. Same is totally true of a character. What a character is looking at is what it's thinking about. That's obvious. What is less obvious is that I am showing you the world, but I can only show you one thing at a time. It's like being in a dark theater with a flashlight. The order in which I show you things becomes very important, because the easiest example is two people walk into the same room. If one of them is a baker, they'll notice the stick of butter on the counter. If one of them's a painter, they'll notice the painting that's crooked on the wall. So you can control what the audience is thinking by the order in which you show something to them, in part because it places more importance on that object. Breath is the second principle, and that is the speed or rhythm with which you do things. You don't normally notice people breathing. So if you go back to the idea that storytelling, that the written word is created to record the spoken word, that's where it comes from. You'll hear that the idea that that an action scene is supposed to have short, punchy sentences. The reason, I think, that an action scene generally has short, punchy sentences is because when you are in the middle of action, you tend to breathe faster.
Sure.
A full stop represents a breath. So I think that that's one of the things that happens. So one of the ways you can manipulate your reader is by controlling what they're looking at, the order in which you show it to them, and the speed with which you deliver something.
Yeah. Like,
an example that I'll use is, you know, if I say, he walked into the room and noticed the blonde in the chair. The chair was a fine ebony hardwood with curved feet on the bottom. The chair is the most important thing, even though I showed it to you seconds. If I have the same guy walk in and man walked into the room, there was a blonde sitting in the chair. She was tall and curvy. The blonde is the most important thing, and that has to do with the amount of time that I spent on it. But I could also say the man walked into the room. There was a chair with a blonde in it versus the man walked into a room. There was a blonde in a chair. You know, that order changes the audience's perceptions of the things that the character is seeing, and that's a way that you can manipulate the reader without being incredibly blatant.
Yeah. But on the other hand, if you are always manipulating or showing one thing at a time, as you say,
you can't help that.
Well, what of ambiguity? How does ambiguity
factor? You can only show one thing at a time because the reader is reading linearly. You're relying on the reader to build a picture, but you can only show them one thing at a time.
Yeah.
And then it's up to them to build the picture. Ambiguity, yes. Ambiguity is, what about ambiguity?
Well, I'm curious how ambiguity works into the puppeteering tenets here. It seems to me that what you are calling for, quite rightly, is a kind of descriptive clarity and a kind of narrative clarity with which to allow the reader to make up, to evoke a particular feeling or a particular thought to get through the book, or to get through a sentence or to get through a paragraph or whatever you want to do. But the question is when you get into ambiguity or a more avant-garde thrust, how are the puppeteering tenets that you particularly use compatible with that?
I don't know. I don't write avant-garde because it doesn't interest me.
Why is that?
I like stories and people. I'm really not interested in stylistic. I mean, despite the fact that I have attempted to, if, you know, I, and this is like when I go see film and everything, that the things that appeal to me are characters and the way they interact with people. And this, and I like stories about that. I like stories with plots and characters. And things that are avant-garde with style for style's sake, I think they have a definite place, and there are times that I can enjoy that, but by and large, it is not something that interests me. That may change,
yeah,
but it's just not something that interests me. Now, that doesn't mean that I think that everything should be completely unambiguous and with only one meaning.
Yeah.
That is equally dull.
Oh, no, no, I'm not suggesting that. I'm not suggesting that. I'm just trying to get a sense of your aesthetic here.
Ambiguity is going to happen, I think. Whether you like it or not, people are going to bring their own stuff to it. I guess for me, it's when I want something to be ambiguous, it is. I'm trying to think of an example of that. An example of how and why and when someone would do that deliberately.
I can think of an example in this book.
Oh, sure.
The moment where there's the implied Congress. The noun Congress could mean so many different things. At least in my mind, it meant many possibilities. Whether it was a reserve for something that could not be uttered, or whether it was actually a more literal form of Congress, of that romantic liaison I'm talking about. I'm trying not to give the book away.
Yes. Unfortunately, I don't remember using the word.
You did, believe me.
Oh, I'm sure.
It caused me to think anyway. I mean, but that seems to me like a kind of ambiguity that's compatible with the storytelling, people-oriented writing that you're interested in doing. That's what you would define your form of ambiguity as, something along those lines.
Yeah, I mean, it is. I guess for me, it's because I tend to write third-person point of view. The ambiguities are in ways that my character misunderstands or interprets something. Sometimes I'll do something where I'll have the character interpret something knowing full well that the audience is probably going to interpret it in the other direction.
Yeah.
But leaving open the possibility that maybe the character's right.
Well, let me help you out here. It seems to me that this kind of collision between...
I should have read the book. That's what I should have done.
Well, it seems to me that what you're talking about here, this collision between causing the reader to think that something is going on when something else is going on, that form of ambiguity, that collision between you, the author, and the reader, that's where your point of evolution as a writer is probably going to be. Is that safe to say?
I guess pushing
that more?
I mean, this is, again, that thing where I can't describe what my back looks like.
Yeah.
In short stories, I've tried very hard to, I've got some things where I try to set up so that the reader is going along one direction. Interesting thing about this, this book is that when I wrote it, I did the first 50,000 words, fully intending for the couples to pair up differently.
Yeah.
Threw 20,000 of them away, and then wrote forward, and then finished the book. So there are scenes in there that I didn't change, which are telegraphing who's going to wind up with whom for a different book.
It was there all along.
No, no, no. I mean, there are, I wanted, female A to wind up with female. Not in 1814.
Yeah.
Or at least not in Jane Austen. And other ones, yes. But I wanted, female A to wind up with male A and female B to wind up with male B. And so there are scenes that telegraph that. But what winds up happening is that female A winds up with male B. And I left it because, actually, I enjoyed the ambiguity of foreshadowing, I guess.
Uh-huh.
Okay, that sort of answers that question. That actually is a nice sort of segue out of a very pleasant conversation. Thanks so much for taking the time out, Mary. It was a pleasure.
Thank you for the time.
Absolutely. All right.